more punishing real estate.
I noticed that this morning.
This isn't real estate.
But so these people aren't regulated, and I'm going to get them regulated.
Yeah.
Is that a drug?
Not regulated. Mobile homes will start regulated.
Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and start House Revenue. It's 2 o'clock, a minute or two after. We are scheduled to start at 2 o'clock. Today is the 16th of June. Welcome to House Revenue Committee. Colleagues, you've got the printed schedule, and we will be going out of order from the printed schedule. I anticipate that we will invite Treasurer Edwards to come forward to discuss issues relative to the reserve fund, and then we'll come back, and Ron Parker has signed up with Lynn Lundquist and Carl Davis to come forward and run a PowerPoint. So we'll get back to that. I had told the treasurer, because he's got an appointment that he's got to be back for in short order, that we would start with him this afternoon, and we will go ahead and just pen the treasurer's arrival. So we'll be at ease for a moment, this will be in the form of a kind of an informational hearing relative to the overall concept of a stabilization fund and reserve funds. So we'll stand at ease for a moment. Public record. Welcome, Treasurer Edwards. Thank you. We appreciate you being here. I know that you have a very busy schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for the delay. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on these two bills. As you know, my job, I've been particularly interested in the establishment and the maintenance of a rainy day fund for the state of Oregon, because rainy day funds, as you also not aware, have been an influence on states' credit ratings, and that is a part of the job that I take very seriously in trying to maintain a strong credit rating for the state of Oregon. Our bond rating, as you know, correlates to the interest rates that we pay on the bonds that we sell. That is, the higher the rating, the less interest the state pays on the bonds that it sells. And conversely, the lower the rating, the more the state pays in interest. Over time, that translates into millions of dollars. One of the few bright spots that we've seen over the last few years with the recession and special sessions and all the scars that many of you have had as a result of those two things was a constitutional amendment that did create a rainy day fund for schools by converting the Education Endowment Fund into the Education Stability Fund. This state never had a rainy day fund, and the national credit rating agencies had repeatedly faulted Oregon for its lack of foresight in this area. Ballot Measure 19, which you referred out, established this rainy day fund for education with the dedicated funding source of the lottery and with triggers for its uses in the event of an economic downturn. The credit rating agencies acknowledge the positive step that the legislature and Oregon voters took in buttressing the state's financial structure and staff off the drastic impact of future recessions by creating this fund. What has been a negative on the state's credit report, the lack of a rainy day fund, has now moved into the positive column. In fact, Moody's rating agency has stated that the rainy day fund measure approved by voters is expected to have a positive long-term credit impact. I've received questions about whether the Education Stability Fund, because it's dedicated solely to education, is an adequate rainy day fund for the state as a whole. My answer is to this question, unequivocally, yes, it is an adequate mechanism. It is a constitutional fund, and it has been recognized by the rating agencies with a dedicated funding source. Further, K through 12 is nearly half of our general fund. At this point, we should concentrate on refilling this fund and maintaining the discipline to reserve its use only for times of true economic downturn. And in part, that's just what Senate Bill 841 and SJR 2 help us do. Senate Bill 841 would help us build the fund faster than we currently are, and SJR 2 would increase the cap so that over time the fund would accumulate an amount that would even be more significant in maintaining state services the next time Oregon experiences another economic downturn. That is why I urge you to support these two bills and pass them. While the credit rating agencies have acknowledged the positive steps that you have taken and Oregonians have taken with the Rainy Day Fund, they continue, though, to cite challenges for the state, including an initiative system, the kicker law, low ending fund balances, and a narrow general fund that relies on a single volatile tax, the income tax. And I understand that attaining improvements in these areas are often very difficult. But small steps are important to take, and I urge the legislature to continue to work in these areas as well. I'm pleased that you're looking at these two bills. I think they're very important for the state of Oregon to improve the continued improvement of the health of the state of Oregon. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, thank you for having me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Treasurer Edwards. We're honored to have you here, and we know that you've got a very busy schedule. Colleagues, are there questions for the state treasurer, Treasurer Edwards? Again, thank you very much, Treasurer. While there's very little we can do about the initiative system and the kicker law is wildly popular, I think there is something that we can do about trying to maintain some kind of an ending fund balance as we move forward with these two pieces of legislation. So, and I want to continue to commend you, Treasurer Edwards, for an excellent fiscal job that you're doing in maintaining and working with the state's credit ratings with our bond folks back in on Wall Street and the positive spin that you always get when you go back to Wall Street. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to recognize the Senate Revenue Chair, Ryan Decker, for his work on these two bills. He helped craft these and bring a group of people to continue to work to find a solution to enhance the economic health of the state, and I think he deserves credit for this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. With that, colleagues, we'll go ahead and open public hearings on both Senate Bill 841, Senate Joint Resolution 2, so that all testimony can be combined into the record. Senator Decker. And again, I just soon had you up with the treasurer, but he had to get out of town, and you got lots of time.
That's right. You know, you didn't get a quarter from me. He's handing out quarters like mad yesterday at Pioneer Courthouse Square. He's still out there if you want to run him up.
I didn't hear any jingle in his pocket as he came in or as he went out, either one.
Well, we had a roll sitting on, but I have an insight into the treasurer's office, but we had a roll of them, so you can blame me now for, I could have brought quarters for the committee.
You have time to go back and get them.
You know what? I think, I might have some in my office, but here I bring this issue up of quarters, and I get the onus, not the state treasurer. Mr. Chair. Ryan Decker, State Senate District 14, Beaverton and Raleigh Hills and Aloha. You are going to hear expert testimony on the contents of the bill, which was developed by the Business Association, the Business Council. If I could, I'd like to give you a little insight into the process that brought you this bill, because we made a conscious decision when we put a work group together that we wanted to do something on a reserve fund. Oregon's at 2% of reserves. We know that's not healthy. We know we're one of three states that gets dinged on a credit rating for not having a healthy and vital enough reserves. And so we made the decision, I think, in the first few days of the session, is we are committed to doing something about that and building adequate reserves so that the hidden tax that we all pay because of the lower credit rating that we have whenever we do a big, important capital project and the hidden tax that we all have to endure by higher interest rates, we would improve that situation and remove that hidden tax and get a better credit rating for the state. And so we put a work group together, and it was, Paul, you'll remind me exactly who was in there, but it was myself, Senator Devlin, Senator Schrader, Senator Morse, and Senator Starr. I think Representative Butler, you graced us with your presence for one of the meetings. And we included the treasurer and some of the folks seated behind me and their input. We ranked the proposals, and we were at least initially wanted to send over the proposal that we sent to you last session, which I will tell you is frankly the proposal that I support the most. And it is using a portion, and Senator Morse has done the heavy lifting on this proposal, it's using a portion of the kicker with the whole idea that in your good years, when you have very good years, you should take a portion of that excess extra revenue that you get and sock it away, take a portion of that, and obviously that was going to have to go to the voters, but we had good polling information on that actually may pass the test, and the polling was at 60-70%, and Senator Morse was going to go out and do another poll because he had worked so hard on this proposal, but we wanted to do something, and that was our number one ranked proposal, and we were teed up and ready to go. It had received, I think, 23 votes last legislative session in the state Senate, but it really did not engender the affection of the state House of Representatives and didn't move out of the state House. And so before Senator Morse did a poll, we decided we would take the temperature of the state House and see how that proposal would be received this legislative session, and if that was something that would receive favorable response. And the answer we got was just a genuine policy disagreement, which is natural, that no, we would not be interested. We don't think we would be interested in that proposal. And that's where you got 841. Is to us, it was the second of the five proposals that we looked at. That was our second ranked. And the benefits, and you'll hear about them, in terms of using the ending fund balance, 2% of the ending fund balance, and that it's statutory, so that obviously it's not locked into the Oregon Constitution. But we thought this is the one proposal that could get, I believe it got 26 votes on the Senate floor, that it's the one that could get the bipartisan support needed to go to the governor's desk, and I know the governor has mixed feelings, and so it might be that one proposal that no one is jumping on a trampoline on saying this is the greatest thing Oregon could do, but it's that one that maybe is the politically realistic one that no one is, that it's a compromise measure, that you use your ending fund balance after the reversions are done, after all that activity has occurred, and that is how you build to at least a 5%, we believe, in 2010 reserve for the state. It gets us on a healthy way towards that goal. And to me, and I guess that would be my testimony to Mr. Chair, I think this might be the viable one politically that we actually could get to the governor's desk and have the votes to pass. So with that, I appreciate this committee's time and deference to this issue.
Thank you very much, Senator Deckert, and as Chair of the Senate Revenue, you've done a great job in bringing this forward, and in the work that has been done. I appreciate the bipartisan fashion in which you've worked this, smithed this out, and worked this through. Other questions of Senator Deckert? Again, you've done a great job, and thank you very much for coming today and for offering the quarters. You can bring them.
They might not have crater lakes on the backs, but I will get you quarters.
I've got a whole pocket full. Don't have crater lakes on the back.
But there's many lobbyists out here. I could probably just have the quarters sent in.
Okay. Thanks again, Senator. We appreciate you being here. Paul, why don't we have you go ahead, and Senator Deckert has touched on it, as the Treasurer Edwards, the background SMS for Senate Bill 841 and Senate Joint Resolution 2.
Okay. Mr. Chair, in your packet there's a table that's labeled Reserve Fund Bills. One page should be in with your material today. Okay, that's the reserve fund bills are the ones that actually this table, and some of you may have seen this table earlier, was quite a bit longer and had the different proposals that Senator Deckert referred to. This is the bottom of your packets. I had the other proposals that Senator Deckert referred to that the Senate Revenue Committee and Senate Work Group looked at, and this is what it's been narrowed down to, is Senate Bill 841 and SJR 2. And as we've talked about reserve fund proposals in the past, we've put four main criteria: the revenue sources that go into the fund, the triggers to get money out of the fund if there's a cap, and then the uses of the funds. Senate Bill 841 draws revenue from the general fund ending balance. It's up to 2% of the general fund ending balance. And what this means is at the end of a biennium, there will be an ending balance, and in fact, the wording and the language in the bill is to calculate that ending balance after all reversions have come in. And that date is actually December 31, following the end of a biennium. So you'll have a final expenditure amount and revenues from that biennium. If that ending balance is more than 2%, the full 2% will go in to the reserve fund. And that transfer would take place under our current operations probably in about February or March, following the biennium.
Paul, let me just ask a question. So that reversion in today's in the scenario of today would be would not happen until December 31st, 2005, and would actually take place sometime probably in February of 2006.
Correct.
And again, using today as an example, the general fund ending balance after all reversions, we've already started to expend that. I mean, that's included in the 12393. Can you give me some feel as to how we would contain ourselves from just going ahead and budgeting that in that session that was called in that year of the ending of the biennium?
Mr. Chair, the way the mechanism would work would be you would have a projected the way it works now, you have a projected beginning balance, and that's what's actually used in your budget process. That projected beginning balance going forward would have an estimate of what that 2% would be. So you would calculate the beginning balance, then it would be minus the set aside or the deposit that would go in the reserve fund up to 2% of revenues from the prior biennium.
Okay, so where the revenues, let's say the revenues for the prior biennium, general fund revenues, I'm assuming, were, let's just assume that they were $10 billion. 2% would be $200 million. Right now, we've because of the extra $100+ million in the May forecast, we're going to have approaching $200 million, $180 million, let's say, in the account. But we've gone ahead and appropriated that, or in the process of appropriating that already. Tell me, and this is statutory, so all it takes is just 31 votes to override Senate Bill 841 of a later date. What's going to solve our appetites for spending that money in advance?
Well, Mr. Chair, first of all, it would go into effect for the 07-09 budget.
Appreciate it.
So if this law is effective, the governor will begin preparing that his recommended budget in spring of 06 and into the fall. And when he releases a budget, he would estimate what his resources are under current law. And he would have his general fund revenue projection, his general fund beginning balance, and then that beginning balance would have to adjust for the 2%. So under current law, and he would have to balance to current law, which would be $200 million less if you're over the 2%.
So really, effectively, all we've done is just reduce the governor's beginning budget because the House or the Senate, the legislature, just on 31 and 16 votes, basically overturns the reservation of that 2%.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, Mr. Chair. But, I mean, if the law stays in effect and the legislature doesn't vote to override it, then you have, in effect, you have taken $200 million out of the beginning balance and set it aside. So, and, of course, that's why, in terms of your table, that's the revenue source. So, I mean, there is no additional new revenue source. You're taking the existing beginning balance and setting that aside. So you would have less available for discretionary spending as a result of this.
And I appreciate that, Paul. I guess my concern is that we've had spending limitations in effect that would require 31 votes to 31 and 16 votes to override those. I'm not sure how many years that it has been in effect that they haven't overridden that, but few. And I know that we've got a new spending limit that's moved up in that process. My concern is that anything that requires 31 and 16 could easily just be overridden, and it really would have just the effect of ratcheting back the governor's estimations, and that would be a great start. I would like to have some greater assurance, and perhaps that's where Senate Joint Resolution 2 might be of some assistance in this process. But I'd like to have some greater assurance that we require more constraint on the part of the legislative members.
Okay. Mr. Chair, in terms of the revenue source, that 2% of up to 2% of the ending balance, that is a statutory revenue source. So as you point out, that could be changed with a majority vote. But once those dollars flow into the Education Stability Fund, it would be the same as 3460, which you discussed, the school finance proposal. Even if you have a statutory revenue source, once it gets in that fund, then you're under the constitutional requirements to pull it out. So you'd have to get a three-fifths vote and meet the triggers, the declining employment and close of session forecast more than 2% below. So those two criteria would be in place. The current cap is now at 5%. And the uses, as the treasurer pointed out, are for public education. And this is where SJR2 comes in. It doesn't change anything in terms of current law, but it does change the cap, which is it's the only change in the proposal, would bump that cap from 5 to 10% of the prior biennium revenue. So I do have a revenue impact prepared for the Senate. We have estimated that the under current law, you do get to the 5% cap in the 2011-13 biennium. So that's when it would begin to have an impact under current projections. Now, if you were to approve Senate Bill 841 and 2% was deposited in the reserve fund, we think you would get to that 5% cap in following the 2007-09 biennium in 2010, in effect. So you would get to that 5% cap if you added another 200 to the reserve fund, and assuming there wasn't any other withdrawals.
The 5% is achieved in 2009 biennium?
Following the 2009 biennium, it would be the transfer that would take place in February of 2010.
Okay.
Would put you over the cap according to our projections for a lottery and assuming that the ending balance was there. I also have, based on the work of the Senate, really the decision of the Senate, made a number of policy decisions in working through this process from the original bill. One was to the bill came to the Senate as establishing a new reserve fund. And what the Senate did through the amendment process was instead of having a new reserve fund, had it go into the Education Stability Fund, so use that existing fund. And in that process, they had a series of discussions. The original bill had an out clause in it in which deposits were not required under current law if the legislature had used the reserve fund, or now the Education Stability Fund, to balance the budget. So that got pulled out inadvertently, really, in the amendment process in the Senate. So I ask counsel to draft up an amendment for you, the A6 amendments, that really puts that back in, because that was the intent of the Senate Revenue Committee. What it does is it has, if there's the adopted budget, which, of course, is your budget at the end of the session, or the approved budget, which would be adjustments you may make during a special session, if you use withdrawals from the Education Stability Fund in those budgets, then you're not obligated to set aside at the end of that biennium. So, for example, after the 2001-03 biennium, we had about $120 million ending balance, not because the state was flush with cash, but just because we had actually borrowed $450 million just to get there, but there was a little bit of excess because there's based on estimates. So under those conditions, 2001-03 and also 2003-05, where you used Education Stability Fund money, with this amendment, there would be no requirement to put the 2% aside, or up to 2%.
Okay, colleagues, there's a question here. Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. My question is, let's say we meet our goal of a 10% set aside in 2010, then we do not have that, the legislature that year and the governor would not have to set aside any additional funds once we reach that cap, just like if we have a year where we have to use those monies. I mean, a cap is a cap, right?
Well, not exactly. And this, in fact, you raise a very important policy decision for you, one that the Senate discussed and decided to go a particular way. Remember how the Education Stability Fund works. It has a cap, but once you get over that cap,
right,
the amount of lottery going in drops from 18 to 15%, but then it flows into the school capital matching fund. So the way this bill is written, and this was a conscious decision on the part of the Senate, was that that would stay in place. So once you hit the cap, whether it be 5% or 10% if SJR 2 is approved, then the excess dollars, the general fund ending balance up to 2%, would flow over into the school capital matching account.
So it's like, follow up,
Representative.
So it's like what we do with a dam in a high snowpack year. You let it overflow X amount, and then mm-hmm. other years it doesn't mm-hmm. come up to the mark. Okay.
But the school capital matching fund would be a separate pool
right.
that it would flow into if you did reach the first
cap. It's the reservoir.
It's the reservoir.
It's the next dam.
Right. Got it. I had to have a picture of it.
Okay. Further questions of staff on the 841 and the proposed A6 amendment. Colleagues, I think we want to probably go ahead and hear from the folks that have signed up for today. Ron Parker, Carl Davis, Lynn Lundquist, if you'd like to come forward. And Ron, I know you've got a presentation.
And, Mr. Chair, we have made copies of Mr. Parker's presentation for you of the slides.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Parker. I represent the Oregon Business Plan, which is a broad coalition of businesses from throughout the state, business organizations from throughout the state. I chair the Public Finance Task Force of that group. And Chairman Butler and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share some remarks with you. Clearly, the issue that you're addressing is one that's of vital importance to the business community. We've expressed that many times and are anxious to reinforce that here today. I do not intend to talk too much about the specifics of Senate Bill 841 or SDR 2, but to really talk about the importance of a stability fund, an adequate stability fund, and just how that plays into the success and the well-being of the state. First of all, the need for public services obviously doesn't go up and down as the tax revenues go up and down. We need those public services in both good and bad times, and that's true with the business community as well. And even though we're arguably a state that has a lot more volatility in its revenue base than many others, until 2002 we were one of just a handful of states that didn't have a stability fund to really help support that. And even now, one could argue that the fund that's in place is not meaningful in terms of what we might need in a true downturn in the economy. Businesses, of course, count on public services just as individual taxpayers do. Schools are vitally important to business interests and are part of what maintains the quality of life, which helps maintain and attract businesses to this state. And that concern, I think, has been a factor in businesses both leaving the state or not coming here over the past few years. The court system is another important element of public services that are necessary in order for businesses to function appropriately. And in 2002, our state had the second largest decline in revenues, as you all know, of any state in the country, going down 20%, which was even more than 18%, the 18% decline in California, and presented extreme problems, which all of you know more about than I do. So obviously, our state is particularly exposed because of the nature of our tax sources. The next slide indicates not only is it volatile. Go to the next one. Not only do we have a volatile source of tax, we are highly dependent on just the one source of tax. And indeed, we are the state that has the highest dependence upon one source of tax of any state in the country. which would suggest that we need a stability fund more than perhaps any other state in the United States. And yet again, we were, until 2002, one of only five states that didn't have anything, as we rely upon the personal income tax for almost 75% of our tax collections. As the next slide indicates, most of the tax, personal income tax, that we do generate in the state comes from households with incomes over $60,000. That makes that source of tax even more volatile because households with those levels of income typically are getting some of that income from capital gains or from bonuses, and those tend to be much more volatile, as we saw in between 2000 and 2001, capital gains declined by 80%. And that obviously led to the situation where between 2000 and 2002, income grew, personal income grew by 6% in this state, yet personal income tax collections actually declined by 10%. Corporate taxes also are highly volatile in this state. And while they're not a huge part of our revenue base, they are very volatile, and as the slide indicates, they declined by 47% between 99-01 and the 01-03 biennium. The next slide is a graph of where the revenue is coming from, and as you can see from this graph, projections are actually pretty good for the next two or three bienniums in terms of the personal income tax revenues. That's a good sign. On the other hand, it shows again the vulnerability that we have to that one source of tax. And it also perhaps suggests to us that if we put a mechanism in place that allows us to capture some of that that building revenue, we'll prepare ourselves better for the next downturn that might come. So what are we to do? Obviously, there are a couple of different ways we can deal with the nature of our tax system, which is highly volatile and highly dependent upon one income source. We could try to reform the tax system, and there's been a lot of talk about that, and clearly there are a lot of advantages in moving that direction. However, the political climate in the state suggests that we're a long ways from convincing the voters on what we need to do there and how we might go about doing it. An alternative to that approach is obviously to build a stability fund, an adequate fund, something that would help to carry us through the next time we have a downturn in tax collections, indeed in the economy. And there is strong business support, as I indicated, for a stability fund. As I indicated earlier, Oregon is one of only five states that didn't have a fund in 2002. A survey of the other states indicates that at the peak of the economic expansion in 2000, they had set aside 10.4% of their budgets for, indeed, a rainy day. So that, you know, suggests to me other states have recognized the need to anticipate the ups and the downs of revenue collections, and indeed have set aside it on average over 10% back when the economy was booming. That again suggests that maybe 5% isn't enough, as the Senate Joint Resolution Bill 2 would address. The current fund, as has been addressed, is limited. It's 18% of the lottery dollars. And as Paul Werner indicated, that's going to take us a few years to get to even the 5%, longer to get to the 10%. So we as a business community favor a process or a mechanism that would allow that to fill up sooner to help protect us again from that economic downturn, which is hard to predict with any kind of accuracy. As the next slide indicates, both government officials throughout the country as well as corporate executives throughout the country have acknowledged the benefit of having a stability fund, of having an adequate stability fund, and as Treasurer Edwards has reported, that does indeed help the state in a number of ways. The next, again, addresses the notion of taking it from 5% to 10%, and again, we support that. And obviously, there may be any number of ways to increase the stability fund and make it more effective tool, and as a broad business community, we don't tell you how to do that, but we certainly favor something coming out of this legislature which addresses that issue. We think it's vitally important that you do act on a bill that does move this stability fund forward. And finally, on the need for reform in this area, we've had some significant challenges, as again you all well know, over the last few years. We really think it's important in order to foster a positive business climate in this state that we take some action in this legislature, and would like to offer the business support to the extent that we can to help you accomplish this, and appreciate your willingness to tackle a difficult assignment, and hope that you can take action. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ron. Ron, the conclusion, don't go home without creating a stability fund. We have a stability fund, an enhanced stability fund, as Richard after there.
That's right.
And I guess I still would have the same question, but I'm going to ask it of the former Speaker of the House relative to the appetite of the legislature to be able to control their appetites once they're in session, because that's a major concern in these kinds of spending decisions, where it only takes 16 or 31 votes to override the will of this legislature in Senate Bill 841. So I'm concerned about that. Questions of Mr. Parker on members of the committee? Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you and testify today. My name is Carl Davis. I am the chairman of the Oregon Business Association and very recently retired vice president of Columbia Sportswear Company. The Oregon Business Association is a group of businesses, large and small, located throughout the state. We understand how the state's ability to provide essential services affects the ability to attract and grow business in the state. The strength of the business is obviously essential to the economic health and viability of the state. Oregon is one of only three states in the union that does not have a rainy day fund, a savings account to allow the state to continue to provide those essential services during a downturn in the economy. Because Oregon relies so heavily on the income tax as the major source of funding for the state, we are particularly vulnerable when there is a downturn in the economy. The funding expected by the schools, by human services, and by public safety providers is not available, and the state as a whole suffers. Earlier today, the Oregon Business Association held a press conference discussing the critical need for the passage of a rainy day fund. In addition to having several business leaders from throughout the state, representing the gamut from large corporations to single person businesses, we also had representatives from education, human resources, and public safety, which spoke to the press. Kent Hunsacker, the executive director of COSA and the former superintendent of the Bethel School District, reminded everybody about how 2 years ago half of the schools in Oregon had to close early, leading to public ridicule in the nation's comic strips. Mary Beth Healy, executive director of Oregonians for Health Safety, related true life stories about Oregonians whose continued payment for prescription drugs was denied at that time, and the resulting serious illnesses that some of these individuals suffered, putting them in long-term health situations and hospitalization paid for by the public, and how much more it has cost us since that time because we didn't pay for those prescriptions. And finally, Bernie Giusto, Multnomah County Sheriff, discussed how he came to the legislature pleading for funds for defense attorneys so that the criminals that had been arrested could be prosecuted for the crimes that they had committed. They had to turn him loose, even though he had available jail space where they could have been housed, because they could not have defenses in the criminal trials. These kinds of horror stories affect not only business, but every person in the state of Oregon. As vice president for Columbia Sportswear, I interviewed a vice presidential candidate for a position with our company 2 years ago. In that interview, the candidate told me that if offered the job, he wasn't sure he would accept it because he was very concerned about moving his family to Oregon, where we had to place his children in an underfunded and failing school system, as he described it. As businesses, We have had to pay ever-increasing health costs for our employees to supplement those individuals who seek health care and have no insurance or ability to pay. Our costs of operating our businesses have increased as we have to beef up our security systems and criminal prevention measures. And our employees live in fear that their neighborhood will be the next meth factory on the block. With problems like these, how can we attract and retain businesses in this state? As business leaders, we know the importance of setting aside a portion of what we make during the flush times to carry us through those periods when there is a downturn. We should be able to expect the same from our state government. We believe that the establishment of a rainy day fund is crucial to the survival and growth of business and thus the economy of our state. I urge you to pass this essential measure. Working together, we can make Oregon great again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Questions directed to Mr. Davis? Thank you again for coming and participating. Lynn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of your esteemed committee. I'm Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. Since OBA's inception 6 years ago, and since I guess I was in the legislature about 11 years ago, the formation and actual funding of a rainy day reserve fund has been our goal. And I will say that as I look back, I guess I'd say I've had a little success. In quotes, I have been part of getting the rainy day fund across the House floor and across the Senate floor. However, they were different bills in different sessions, so I guess I say we still have a lot of work to do, but perhaps there is an opportunity. All of you know, particularly with the presentations made here, of why we ought to have a rainy day fund, and I will not talk about why. The question is not should we do it. The question is this. Do we have the resolve and will we have the backbone to make sound public policy decisions in this arena that trumps the political desire to be everything to all people as we spend money in this state, as you talked about, Mr. Chair? I hope my testimony will come across to you that both OBA and myself are very passionate about this issue. And more importantly than that is the fact that we're optimistic about the fact that in this, the sixth year of this new century, it's actually going to happen. You rightfully might ask, why now should we be successful when we failed in times past? I believe there are three basic reasons. First, all of you and to some degree the public are painfully aware of what happened during the last recession. Secondly, the resolve in this building, as far as the time I've been here, is stronger than it's ever been in times past that, yes, before we go home, we better have some kind of a rainy day fund enhancement, as you, again, have alluded to. And we need to do more than just talk about it. We need to make it happen. And lastly, OBA believes that Senate Bill 841, along with SJR 2, combines policy and politics into a proposal that nearly everyone can support. And I think Senator Decker talked about this. This is not my preference of the best way to have a rainy day fund. But it's time to move on to what is doable. I've met with nearly all of the legislators in the building, both Senate and House, and not one has said this is a dumb idea, we shouldn't do this. It's only a matter of do we have the resolve to do it. That's the question. And some of them might not like every aspect of it. They might not all thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but they all wanted to be part of this process. Phrases such as, that's a common sense that the public will understand. It's physically sound and not politically poisoned. It minimizes the backlash of actually taking some dollars out of the general fund. And that's an innovative way of finding a midpoint between philosophy that there's never enough money so that nothing can come out of the income stream and the philosophy that we must downsize government through a fixed spending limit. So we're trying to find the middle ground. Now, very briefly, let me describe what Senate Bill 841 does. The description, I must say, does contain the amendment that Dr. Warner has suggested that the Senate would like to have as part of this bill. Simply, it's very simple when you really look at it. It transfers the ending balance into reserve account instead of going to the beginning balance the next session. That's the bottom line. That's what it does. The maximum amount, as you've heard, is 2% of the general fund. That's the maximum that can be put in there. And I'm sure you may have seen the figures before, or Paul can make them available, where the ending balance has been as high, and most of you will not maybe believe this, as $800 million. I think that was in 1990. Mm-hmm. Paul, help me out.
In your packets, I think, is the revenue impact statement from SB 841A, and that shows the ending balance through going back to 89-91, and Lynn's memory's right, 95-97 is $800 million.
So that's why we capped it. Again, the politics of the issue, that if you put that large a number of dollars into the don't put that in the beginning balance. If you take that much out, you don't have the politics to make it happen. It's that trying to reach that combination. The two of them together, 841 and SJR2, providing the public would approve it, of a 10% cap on the fund, which I think is basically appropriate. And it also has requirements, since it's part of the Education Stability Fund, that there are certain conditions that need to be met, so that it can't constantly be raining in Oregon and taking that out. And I'll answer your question about that in a little bit. Now, what it doesn't do, and I think this is equally as important, it's not only what it does and what it doesn't do, as amended with the dash sixes. It does not put the ending balance does not take the ending balance and take that from the beginning balance the next session in any buy-in that you actually use the stability fund. And I think it just makes a lot of fiscal sense. Just take this one for an example. In the 03-05 biennium, when you put that together, you use the reserve fund. So, and you have an ending balance, and correct me, I'm not sure about this, Dr. Warner, but I believe the projected one now is about $292 million. I think that's where it is, about $292 million, that you are going to use in the budget you're putting together, okay? And we're saying we've been in tough times. Now is not the time to save. We ought to do the same thing we do in business, you do in your home. When times are better is the time to save. So we're trying to put a little bit of fiscal responsibility at the bottom of the trough. By the same token, let's have the resolve to take the money out and put it into the beginning, to the ending balance rather, and into the reserve account when times are better. The second thing that it doesn't do, it does not touch the kicker. Now, some of you that have followed me and served with me know that I have been on that bandwagon. And I still believe, just a straight fiscal sense, that is the most prudent way and the best fiscal way in which to put our ending balance or our reserve together. I have been hit over the head enough times with a two before, like the perennial donkey or mule, and it's not going to happen. And with all due respect to some people in the legislature and people outside that still want that to happen, I think the odds of that are about like going to Las Vegas and being a millionaire. Now, it could happen, but I don't think it happens. And getting that bill out of the legislature is not the tough part. The tough part is, as the good chair indicated, is getting it by the people. And so it's not, the way we define the bill, the kicker is not part of that. In closing, let me just say this. The politics side of this, some people would say, okay, let's just take it out at the beginning of the biennium. Let's take it 2% out of the beginning. The politics of that, having been knocked around before, are very, very difficult. What you're doing at the beginning of the session, you are taking kids out of school, you're shortening the school years, you're taking seniors on the street, all the things you want to talk about. But when you get to the end of the biennium, you've already met all of your obligations. You've made those tough choices up front. Now at the end of the biennium, I call it the Joe Sixpack analysis. You paid all your bills. You met all your obligations. Doesn't it make just one whale of a lot of sense to put that aside for some day you're going to need down the road? It's just about that simple, in my opinion. I think all of you, you understand what we're talking about. It's just, again, do we have the resolve to do that? And I guess my final thought is simply this. I think the stars of need and desire are lined up for a change. And I think we better take advantage of this opportunity, because unfortunately even two years from now, when things are getting better, I've been in the legislature on those conditions, and I know we didn't have the result. So let's make it happen now when we know it just happened in regard to a recessionary and what it can do to the budget. I would just, one comment, I guess, in finishing up. Mr. Chairman, I would lobby you and your committee. I know this is scheduled to go to the Budget Committee. I think it has a referral to the Budget Committee. I would lobby you and the committee to do the work on it. Let's do whatever you want to here in regard to working the bill and making the changes. You put the House fingerprints on it. You have a committee that's certainly, I believe, is capable of doing that. I don't think that you have maybe quite the workload in the next number of days that the Budget Committee will have. And I think the capabilities here, and that would be my, request. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Lynn, I want to express my appreciation for your stick-to-itiveness, the stamina of staying after this issue. I know it's long been an issue that you've worked towards to try and bring us to the point where we can have an opportunity to get a rainy day fund. But I also recognize that you can see and understand and have been able to masterfully work the art of a politically possible. So this might be the magic number on 841 at this particular point. I certainly hope it is. Questions for former Representative Speaker of the House, Representative Lundquist. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I join you in thanking you for coming forward with this and sticking to it, and most of all for coming before this committee seeking something that doesn't directly benefit your business or industry, because we see a lot of that. Which in some ways we can engage business more to come forward with Oregon bills and Oregon solutions.
Thank you, Representative Hass. Further questions or comments? Lynn, your request is that we would go back to the speaker and ask that the budget subsequent budget referral be removed. Is that your question,
Mr. Chairman? No, my request is simply that you work the bill. When you're done with it, go ahead and send it to the Budget Committee.
Well, my hope today, Lynn, is that we can, in work session, move the A6, which completes the work on the bill, so far as I know, based upon what the testimony we've heard, and that we move it as fast as we possibly can over to Budget so that those folks can proceed forward. And as I know that you've worked on this since the beginning of the session, you've got those folks pretty much lined up. They're well wired at this point to proceed to get this done.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to slow the process down because I understand very well. I also want to respond to your prior question to some people about, how do you keep the legislature's fingers off of this? I will offer a suggestion and let you decide whether you think it's necessary or not. There is that window, if you will, from the time you come into session, that you have actually an option to, I guess, affect the ending balance on two budgets. There's that option there. The proposal has been made by some people, if you want to close the door as much as possible on that, that to amend this in any way would take a 3/5 vote, where you were talking about before, in order to make that happen, so that it would be just as difficult whether it was inside or outside of the stability fund. Now, I hope I have the workings of that right, and I'll certainly be correct if that's not true. And I'm not necessarily saying to do that, but I'm saying if that is a real concern, I would like to see this committee, I would like to see the bill come out of here where I'm not sure how many are going to support this, but all those that do support it would support it. Because they feel it's right and ready to go.
Thank you very much, Lynn. I think that probably it was a couple of sessions ago that I tried to do that in order to keep folks from tampering with the amounts that are set aside for a rainy day or as an ending balance, that we would need a 3/5 majority. And I was explained to then by counsel that that requirement can be overcome by just 31 votes and 16 votes. So unless Paul, do you have any additional thoughts on the on a supermajority and a statutory bill?
Mr. Chair, the message from council is correct. I mean, it would be a statute that could be changed by a majority, but it would be a statement that under current law that the legislature feels that 3/5 should be the required amount. So, I mean, it is, personally, I don't think it could be ignored by any means by a future legislature, but they could override it technically with a majority vote.
And while they couldn't ignore it, they could just cite that particular statute notwithstanding and just plow ahead with 31 and 16. And that's always been the frustrating part of working with the statute. And Lynn, you have plenty of experience in doing that. So, other questions of Lynn or Carl or Ron?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hess.
Could that language be inserted into the constitutional resolution?
I'm sure that it probably could, and I think the constitutional. The 3/5 language is already there in this Senate Joint Resolution. In other words, it's already vested in the Education Stabilization Fund. Mm-hmm. So,
keep in mind, Mr. Chair, you have the two elements. This is the revenue source, mm-hmm. and as it goes into the constitutional fund, it takes 3/5 to get it out. But you can stop it from going in with a majority vote.
Right.
So, unless that became part of the Constitution, that 2% must be set aside.
Be happy to explore anything, Representative. I think it was Representative Lundquist when he was the Speaker of the House that said, you know, you guys get around this budget and it's just like setting a plate of chocolate chip cookies in front of a high school football team around the table. I mean, they don't leave until it's all gone. And that's the concern that I have is that we just don't leave until it's all gone, including anything that's sitting there under 841. That we're trying to protect to make sure that it becomes a portion of that stabilization fund for public education. Other questions? Any questions? Any final comments? Representative Lundquist, Carl, or Ron?
Mr. Chairman, I might just indulge in one quick comment. I agree with you exactly what you're saying. I do think it's different from a political standpoint from all of you sitting up there. To have to take an action of saying, okay, we're not going to do what the statute says we're going to do, fully realizing you can. And I think there's a hopefully there's more strength in here than what those of us who are on the inside know what we can do. Because the public out there will not look kindly on that. But your point is absolutely well taken, and I not disagree with that at all, sir.
My concern, Lynn, is this, that when it comes down to Sinodyne, and again, you've been there, done that, and got the T-shirt for it. When it comes down to Sinodyne, folks are going to say, wait a minute. The only thing I'm voting on is a bill that says that particular ORS notwithstanding, we're going to vote to go ahead and balance the budget today. And they're looking at that, and it's part of an omnibus bill, which has everything, including the kitchen sink, and sometimes it's leaking pretty badly, and it's all in there, and you just say, if that's what it's going to take to get us out of this building rather than stay here another 2 or 3 months, then for goodness sakes, let's vote yes. And of course, the bad press comes with that for a period of 2 or 3 days, and then people say, hey, men, women, and children are now much safer. Those guys aren't around Salem anymore, so... Anyway, I am concerned about that, but I'm open to any suggestions from members of the committee or yourself, Lynn, on behalf of OVA and other members that could come forward that would help us to do that. But I'd love to be able to do something. If you want to hold the bill over, I'm prepared to work the -A6 if you want to hold it over.
I would say unless there's a discussion, let's just move A6 and
okay.
Go ahead and move.
And again, we have where this is Senator Deckert's bill, and I'm anxious to honor his request that we move the A6 and move it forward in the process. But I would be happy to entertain any because we can come back and work it again on Tuesday, and that would certainly be enough time to have vetted that with Senator Deckert, Senator Nelson. And had your expert help in that process. Representative burgers.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment that you are, I think, in this room, the most experienced member, and I hate to say, but you're somewhat jaded in here. It's disconcerting for those of us who have not been through as many, I would be somewhat more optimistic that there were something like this clearly in place, that there are plenty of advocacy groups who would remind us of the statutory promise that we made before we signed this some omnibus that gets us out the door and forgets this little piece called education stability. Maybe I'm just haven't been around enough to be that jaded. But
your optimism is appreciated, because I was there just a few years ago myself and said, we got to do this. It's the right thing to do. And it was those that had been here much longer than I said, oh, that's a great idea. It just doesn't work. Oh, okay.
But
and after
here.
A couple of sessions, I gave up on it. But don't give up.
Okay.
Don't give up. Stick together on it.
I refuse.
Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think somewhat what Representative Berger was saying, because we've got to move now. And the reason I say that is Mr. Davis brought up a very good point. He talked about in his testimony that the defense attorneys went out of money for it.
Right.
And so we're already standing here saying we need a rainy day fund and we need to save it this biennium, right, Lynn? But we want to spend more money for defense attorneys, and likewise, we're spending 1,400% more for defense attorneys than we are district attorneys. And so if we're going to do something this session, we better get it moving yesterday, because so does the director, Chair. We wait till next Tuesday, we might not have anything left to do anything with. So.
Well, colleagues, this isn't effective until next session. And if I think that Senator Deckert would certainly understand if we held this over. There's not a we will plan to meet on Tuesday of next week, and we'll have a regular post of what it is that we'll attempt to do. And in compliance with what Lynn is indicating, get it the very best you can in this legislative body, the committee before which the bills are being heard today. I would certainly entertain an amendment that would say let's do it this way. Now that doesn't mean it doesn't get yanked out over in the budget committee before they pass it. But my hope is that those folks would recognize a strong mandate from this particular committee that says this is important to us. And I would want senators Deckert and Nelson to acquiesce in that amendment. And I don't know of any reason why they wouldn't. But
I don't know either.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Colleagues.
We are still moving this to another committee.
Eventually, it does. Eventually, it does go to a budget committee. Yes.
Yes. So,
no.
Are we in work session now?
No, we are not.
We still have one more.
So, it would be my preference to move this out, but I'm not.
I would add one caveat. SGR 2 is actually going to state and federal affairs.
It isn't going to budget?
No, 841 is, but SGR 2 is going to state and federal affairs. So they're going to two different committees.
Look at the draw. Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. I can't get the image of it's best thing since sliced bread. When we had the automatic bread slicers, a lot of people lost the essence of learning how to make homemade bread. But
well, at least the slices are always funny. bigger at the bottom than they are at the top, and I don't understand that.
Representative, I'm still thinking about those chocolate chip cookies.
Well, I'm hung up on the homemade bread that I haven't had time to make for 5 months.
Make it on the weekend.
But I guess my preference would be to get it the best we can get it here before we send it off. And, if I want to send you a loaf of homemade bread, it's going to be the best I can give you.
Thank you very much. Representative Bradley is right.
Mr. Chair, since you're taking, a straw poll, as it were, my preference would certainly be to get this out of here, and hopefully that if it needs something, it's got another stop. The senator and these folks have a chance to talk to those committees. My preference is to append the A6 and get it out of here.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Colleagues, we do have one other person signed up, Rick Bennett from AARP, to testify on Senate Bill 841.
He's going to tell us the other way.
Thank you very much. Thank you,
awesome.
I will.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks so much for coming.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett representing AARP Oregon. One of the great things about following a panel like you just had, very knowledgeable and a good discussion by the committee, is that there's really very little more for me to say. We support the reasoning for enhancing the current reserve fund. We support the increasing of the cap. We think that's a good policy as well. And we share your concerns related to what might happen to those funds before they get into the stability fund. So with that, thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick. Any questions of Mr. Bennett? Thanks again.
Just to be makes bread.
colleagues, before we go into work session, I guess it would be proper to ask. We do have the A6, and I intended to pass the A6 and move this, but I also would certainly defer to Representative or to Senator Deckard if he would like to have an opportunity to put the suggested language in. I'd be delighted to have the language in there, and I don't know that
you know that.
I don't know that it gets put in there in the budget. If we put it in, it's liable to get pulled out in the budget committee. So I guess that would be my desire. Any further discussion, members of the committee? What's your desire in that regard when we go into work session?
You can move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Colleagues, with that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 841 and on Senate Bill 30 or Senate Joint Resolution 2. We'll close the public hearing on those, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 841. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 841.
Colleagues, the A6 amendment of 616-05 to Senate Bill 841 is moved by Representative Berger. Discussion relative to the motion. Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection to the motion, and all members being present, the A6 is appended.
Sales tax
bill. Yeah, this is sales tax. Right.
And you get to carry it.
You didn't even know we had one.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 841 as A6 amended to the committee, the House Budget Committee.
With a
due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move Senate Bill 841 as it's been amended today with the A6 amendments appended thereto to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Is there objection to that motion?
You've taken a strikeout.
Well, Representative, it appears that the majority are against this.
Okay, because I was not paying attention when you talked to the other end of the dais.
I think the group would like to see it move forward, okay. and then we're going to leave it up to Representative Lundquist to see if he can go down to the budget committee and get the.
Sure?
As a matter of fact, you'll probably give him a note to mother to do that, won't you, to get
sure.
those amendments?
I don't have any problem with that.
We're still strong. I think everyone's strong on the idea, and I'd be delighted to see that happen. So with that, colleagues, yes, we'll just hold for just a moment. We'll be in recess for just a moment.
Wanted to make sure we have to rescind.
Yeah, this is one of the later assignments. Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, and recognizing Representative Esquivel was a yes before he had to step out. Representative, how have you grabbed Representative Esquivel? He's used to the Senate rules still. Okay. Is there any objection to the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing no objection, Senate Bill 841, as amended with the A6 amendment dated 616, is moved with a two-pass recommendation to the House Budget Committee. So ordered. And let's see. We will close the work session on 841 and open the work session on Senate Bill 2. Paul, I didn't have anyone sign up on Senate Bill 2, and I would like your staff summary.
Okay.
Senate Joint Resolution 2, I believe.
Mr. Chair, SJR 2 literally changes one number in the Constitution. The current Education Stability Fund has a cap of 5% of the prior biennium general fund revenue. Once that cap is reached, then you reduce the lottery dedication from 18 to 15%, and it starts flowing into the sub-account for school capital matching. If you look at your revenue impact dated 5-4 in your packet, you can see the current projections for the Education Stability Fund of $201,376,000. These are at the end of the biennium. And we think by the 11-13 biennium, as I said earlier, we would actually be about $12 million over the 5% cap, assuming no withdrawals between now and 11-13, which meaning probably no recessions, which, you know, is problematic to say the least. But we would begin to reach it much sooner with 841 in place. We're estimating, as I said earlier, 2010, that transfer in the early part of the calendar year of 2010. So under SJR2, the 10% cap, instead of being $769 million in 11-13, it would actually be $1.4 billion. So it would have the effect of doubling that cap. One thing we have looked at and talked about from an analytical standpoint is the way the cap is set. If you just have the current revenue source, ignoring 841, we think lottery eventually is going to slow down once we get the set games in place and grow maybe 4 to 5% a year. And we think that the general fund, as we've talked about over the long term, will grow about 6% a year. So that target, you know, it's going to be tough to get to the 10% with just simply this one revenue source. So it becomes particularly an important issue if you include another revenue source. If not, it's less significant or much more in the distant future.
Questions of staff, Representative Berger?
A comment. Now I'm jaded.
wow, that was shorter than...
I never thought the lottery would do what it's doing now. I always have predicted that people are going to come to their senses and quit gambling, but I'm sorry I have been wrong.
Yeah. Well, Representative Berger, many of us have underestimated, but we're not saying that people are going to come to their senses and quit gambling, but we're saying that their increases in gambling is going to be at a slower rate. I mean, at some point it's going to be like any other consumer good and will grow like incomes, probably somewhat less than income grows. And, of course, the income tax is elastic, so the general fund, we think, in the long term, will grow faster.
You probably think that Oregonians are different, that the state budget won't get addicted to gambling either, huh?
Sorry.
Further questions of staff relative to the staff major summary as presented on Senate Joint Resolution 2? Colleagues, Senate Joint Resolution 2 has a subsequent referral to the House State and Federal Affairs Committee, and there are no amendments presented today on Senate Joint Resolution 2. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair?
Okay. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon.
I'm sorry. Just one quick question.
Yes. Representative Gleason.
What's the logic to send these to different committees?
These were previously assigned by the Speaker of the House. I'm going to guess that that there was work to be done in the
Senate or the House Committee on State and Federal Affairs. I don't know. I really, they breathe a different rarefied air out there in those offices than I'm very accustomed to here.
Okay. Mr. Chair, now I don't know from any discussion with the Speaker's office. The one issue, certainly in terms of SJR 2, is what election to send it to. And the way the bill is currently set up, it would go to the next regular general election. So that may be a decision.
Because there is a small fiscal depending upon where you do send it. That's right.
Right, and the timing of when it would go before voters.
Okay, that's an excellent response. Much better than mine. I vote for your response. Representative Berger?
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
We are in work session.
Then I move SJR 2 to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
The motion.
A resolution is a do adopt.
The motion is to send Senate Joint Resolution 2 to the House Committee on State and Federal Affairs with a do adopt motion. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Are there any objections to the motion? Representative, let's go ahead and have a vote.
I do.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and have a vote on it.
Representative Bocart.
Yes.
Representative Esperville?
Aye.
Representative Felicio?
No.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Haas?
No.
And Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. The motion, having received the necessary constitutional majority, is passed, and Senate Joint Resolution 2 will move to the House Committee on State and Federal Affairs with a do-adopt motion. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 2. And colleagues, Senator Westland is here to testify on behalf of a potential amendment on Senate Bill 31. So we will open the work session on Senate Bill 31. Lizbeth, do you want to just bring us up to date on 31?
Chairman Butler, you have two amendments, so maybe I'll just go through Senate Bill 15 amendment to 31, which is what Senator Westland is here on. So the 15 amendment, basically this was one of the Department of Revenue's original bills dealing with just who actually could be held liable for not withholding personal income taxes from employee wages. And now the 15 amendment is dealing with the residential energy tax credit to taxpayers who basically purchase large solar electric systems. So this is the contents of Senate Bill 733, and we did hear that in the Senate earlier this week. And basically what this bill does is with this residential energy tax credit, it's allowing a larger amount of the tax credit to be allocated over each year in which taxpayer takes it. So basically, if you purchase one of these solar electric systems, the limit then on this residential energy tax credit is $3 per watt of installed output up to $2,000. Up to 2,000 watts or a total amount of $6,000. And the one thing that was discussed on the Senate side was also putting a limit on the tax credit as far as the amount of the percent of the total cost of the solar electric system in case these solar electric systems go down in cost over time. So this basically puts the limit then of 50% of the installed cost of the solar electric system is what the tax credit is also limited to. And there still is in current law. Current law, the residential energy tax credit is limited each year at $1,500. That's still in place. But the difference under current law is current law, you would have to each year make new investments in order to get another $1,500 tax credit. This allows you then to have $6,000 total, and then you could carry that forward over 4 years so that you have a five-year carry-forward on this tax credit under existing law. This just allows people to use more of the tax credit for bigger purchases without having to make purchases each year. And some of them are doing that already. So there's embedded in the revenue impact for this bill, you've got then already an assumption that some taxpayers each year will already be getting a $1,500 credit because they'll be purchasing additional solar electric panels in order to increase the amount of wattage they can have in their electric system. But then this would just allow them to make one purchase and then just take that over a longer period of time. So the revenue impact begins in 2007-09 biennium, because even though the tax years begin for this tax credit change, tax year 2006, the first year you assume that they would already, under existing law, get a $1,500 tax credit. So this begins in an 07-08 fiscal year. And so for the 2007-09 biennium, it would be a loss of $524,251, and then by the 2009-11 biennium, a loss of $786,231. So, basically.
And it's assumed that these were previously, the law was set up so that you'd add 500 watts at a time.
Yes.
I guess.
And that's the idea. This is really just allowing them to make bigger purchases.
2,000 watts right up front, and then amortize it over 4 years.
Yeah. And we have seen quite a growth in this. You can see there in 2002, there were 40 taxpayers who took these kind of the tax credit for these solar electric devices, where in 2003, 60. And then by 2004, they had 170 taxpayers taking that tax credit. So it is an area that a lot of people are going into as far as an electric source.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hess.
Ms. Beth, if you take advantage, if you get a solar system this year or next, and this law passes, will you be able to use the new law even if you purchased your solar equipment now?
Yeah, Representative Hess, there's not a retroactive component back. So if you had purchased it after January 1st, 2006, then yes, you could use this law if this passes. But if you purchased it right now in 2005, no.
Okay.
Number 17. Go for number 17.
Yeah, 17 is permanent.
We're amending an existing law. Right? It's not creating a new law.
It is amending the existing law.
That's right.
I'm just checking to see. You know, I'm going to fire that Mormon tree today. I got only 16 too, just like a woodchipper. I haven't ever been to any checks.
Senator Westland, welcome. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, and I'm here to testify, obviously, on behalf of the Dash 15 amendments to Senate Bill 31, which functionally inserts in its entirety Senate Bill 733 into Senate Bill 31. This is not just a bill about increasing solar energy use in Oregon. It is, in very large part, also about creating jobs. It's about Oregon's future. This bill will help produce small business construction jobs in companies located throughout Oregon. Central Oregon already has a burgeoning industry that could be boosted with this legislation. Many jobs will be created in Eastern Oregon, a region that desperately is in need of economic development incentives. As an aside, I'd just like to point out that Central and Eastern Oregon has more sunshine per annum than even Florida. I believe Representative Butler could also testify to that effect. But beyond the construction jobs, this bill will help Oregon in the highly competitive race to attract renewable energy manufacturers. These are significant economic concerns, and any state would be proud to have them.
You have some of those in Deschutes County presently, don't you, Representative?
Not significant. We have PV power. We have a very burgeoning alternative, renewable, sustainable energy industry.
Shipments all over the world, I think.
Shipments all over the world, PV powered, leading inverter technology, which converts solar panel direct current to alternating. We also have Idatec, which is the leading fuel cell manufacturer, you know, technology in the world. But this is not just Central Oregon. Isophoton, the largest manufacturer of photocells in the world, a Spanish company, is desperately looking at moving into Southern Oregon, into Representative Escobar's district. So I mean, like I say, this has statewide implications. And really what these businesses are seeking is a signal, a sign that Oregon is going to step up and value renewable energy on a par with our neighbors. Dash 15 amendments help send that message. And you look at the growth potential. I mean, solar energy is growing on a worldwide basis at 30% per annum. I mean, this literally is the wave of the future. And we have, like I say, some leading attractions. They like to cluster. They like to cluster where there's new technology. They like to cluster where they're valued. Oregon has a nationally recognized reputation in the solar industry. We are currently competitive in the incentives we offer, but just recently Washington and California have passed legislation that puts us far behind in this competition, if you will. The Dash 15s and Senate Bill 733 are the step that we must take to remain competitive in an industry that creates living wage jobs, is the economic wave of the future, and is good for all Oregonians. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Westland? Yes, Representative Boquist.
Yes, Senator, I just got some ask. I mean, we're talking about renewable energy, and we're at the Dash 15 amendment. I mean, there were 14 amendments before this.
Mm-hmm. Remember, this is the Department of Revenue bill.
Okay.
Yeah, this is his first amendment to this bill.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to entertain the 16s to apply to wood chippers in your, you know, your specific.
Oh, the 16s are already cool.
Oh, well, I'm behind the curve, you know, as usual. Just also for the record, Mr. Chair, based on a previous comment, Representative Berger indicated that she was jaded, and while she may be jaded, she is always beautiful.
Oh, how badly do you want to
vote?
Vote right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator. Further discussion, colleagues, I told Mr. Russell on the Dash 16s that we would probably come back on this on Tuesday, so at that time we'll probably go ahead and tend to...
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask the obvious question. Why is Representative Escobar getting another business down in Medford?
Mr. Chair, may I answer that?
I think you better.
I think it's because they wanted more sunshine. We're losing it. We're getting it from Central Oregon.
It is true. It is true, and I want to report that Malheur County, Oregon, gets over 300 days a year of sunshine. So. I mean, we only have 9 inches of total moisture in an entire year. I think we got that last month. So, it's a great place to live if you don't mind the sunshine. And I'm having regularly now, having worked in the family brickyard for a few years, skin cancer removed on a regular basis. Everything has.
Well, I don't think a lot of people know that on our Oregon State Capitol we have 25 voltaic panels. Drawing in solar power. Sure, I don't think that's been enough to power that projector, but in normal years it helps.
Well, and I think we were the first state capital to add alternative energy in that fashion, as I recall, nationwide. I took the credit on it several years ago.
Oh, good.
I mean, I have solar power. My entire ranch in Turgon has solar power. Every building has solar power on it. Even though, you know, the moss kind of covers up the panels, that's where we have the dark solar power for the lights.
You're killing the industry.
Colleagues, with that, we'll post again for next week when we have the agenda identified, and the Senate is passing out has passed out a few bills that we will be receiving and hope to bring us back into a meeting and productive, meaningful and productive work session early next week. So with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 31, and with that, we will close House Revenue for the day. Thank you.
Luckily, the battery's starting to...